Praise the Lord. Good morning to you all. We have been looking at a number of Old Testament passages that show us something about our approach to God, our approach to His Word. And in Numbers 11, today we are going to see an instance where sometimes the worst thing God can do is to give us exactly what we ask for, right? All of us bring desires to God. Some of those desires are out of our new self, our new creation, and others of those desires are fleshly, out of our old self or old person. And when we bring this kind, the old kind, repeatedly, over time, the best thing God can do is restrain us from them. The worst thing for us is if and when He says, "All right, that's what you want. There you go." Romans 1 gives it to us in a proposition form when it says that God gave them over to their desires. Proposition. Numbers gives it to us in a picture. Numbers 11, the graves of desire, when God giving you what you want isn't what you want. Last week in Leviticus, we saw instructions for approaching God the right way. You get to Numbers. First part of the book is the arrangement of the community around the presence of God, numerically in the census, spatially around the tent. You get to 10 and they move for the first time. You get to 11 and the action begins. First three verses of chapter 11 are sort of a generic rebellion, a model rebellion, if you will, just sort of a skeleton form of one. Verse 4, we get an account with much more detail. And so Casey's going to read for us selected verses, Numbers 11, 4, and following.
The rabble with them began to crave other food. And again the Israelites started wailing and said, "If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna." Moses heard the people of every family wailing, each at the entrance to his tent. And the Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. He asked the Lord, "Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms, as a nurse carries an infant, to the land you promised on oath to their forefathers? Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing to me, 'Give us meat to eat.' I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. If this is how you are going to treat me, put me to death right now, if I have found favor in your eyes, and do not let me face my own ruin." The Lord said to Moses, "Bring me 70 of Israel's elders who are known to you as leaders and officials among the people. Have them come to the tent of meeting, that they may stand there with you. I will come down and speak with you there, and I will take of the spirit that is on you and put the spirit on them. They will help you carry the burden of the people, so that you will not have to carry it alone. Tell the people, 'Consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow, when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed, 'If only we had meat to eat, we were better off in Egypt.' Now the Lord will give you meat, and you will eat it. You will not eat of it for just one day, or 2 days, or 5, 10, or 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and have wailed before him, saying, 'Why did we ever leave Egypt?'" But Moses said, "Here I am among 600,000 men on foot, and you say, 'I will give them meat to eat for a whole month.' Would they have enough if flocks and herds were slaughtered for them? Would they have enough if all the fish in the sea were caught for them?" The Lord answered Moses, "Is the Lord's arm too short? You will now see whether or not what I say will come true for you." Now a wind went out from the Lord and drove quail in from the sea. It brought them down all around the camp to about 3 feet above the ground, as far as a day's walk in any direction. all that day and night, and all the next day, the people went out and gathered quail. No one gathered less than 10 homers. Then they spread them out all around the camp. But while the Lord was still the meat was still between their teeth and before it could be consumed, the anger of the Lord burned against the people, and he struck them with a severe plague. Therefore, the place was named Kibrot Hatava, because they were buried, the people who had craved other food. The word of the Lord.
Okay, another one of those passages, right? Really, there are at least three different errors in this account. It is as intricate and complex as verses 1 to 3 are generic and simple. Moses makes an error when he complains, verses 11 to 15. We'll come back to that one at the end. Joshua makes a mistake of his own in a little side episode that we did not include in the reading. And part of God's immediate solution to Moses' complaint is to anoint these 70 elders with the Holy Spirit. That leads to a curious episode where two of them stay back but still prophesy in another part of the camp, and Joshua complains about it. And we will likely get to that a little bit next week. All right, so Moses, Joshua, but the main error, of course, is the people themselves. The people say in verse 4, what Moses has provided is not enough. If you remember, Moses, in some of these passages, is a little bit like a Bible in the flesh walking around. And so in a sense, they are right. It's true. The Bible would not just be the five Mosaic books, the five books that Moses was the impetus behind. God would add others, the history books, the prophetic books, the wisdom literature, and some of them would come from completely unexpected quarters, Eldad and Medad back in the camp. So in a sense, they're right, but mainly, this is a story of what happens when people rebel against God and are not grateful for the things he has provided for us, when we complain against him. God, what you have provided, your manna, your word, what you have given for me, it's not enough. And I'm going to look to something else. I'm going to look for something else to step in and fill this need that I still have. And each of us do that with something. There's something in your life, something in your heart, something in my heart that we look to and say, if only I had that instead. And this is a story of what happens when we do. Now take a look at verse 4, if you would. The people are in the desert. They come out of Egypt. It's been a year and 2 months since the Exodus, a little less than 2 months since the event we saw last week in Leviticus. By the way, they've been eating manna for a long time. And they say to Moses, they say to God, we want some meat. We want, if only we had some meat. It's natural enough. I can relate to that. But what comes next is what alerts us that there is something else up in this passage. Verse 5, we want some meat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt. And then down in verse 6, we ate all this stuff and it was free. It was free. And of course, it wasn't free. They were slaves. They were paying for it with their lives. They were paying for it with their children's lives. But they have this selective memory. They complain about the manna, and God hears their request, and God says, fine, here you go. And he gives them quail in such a quantity. This wind sweeps in. It brings birds all over the camp. Picture this, birds to a height of 3 feet all over the camp, as far as you can see. And the people gather this astounding, almost unimaginable quantity of meat, of quail. And God says, not just will you eat it, you are actually going to get more than you want. You're going to get more than is good for you. In the end, you are going to end up with quail coming out of your nose. And while they are eating it, very graphically, we are told, while it was still between their teeth, before it could be consumed, God struck. His anger burned, and many of the people died. destroyed by the very thing they had asked for. Now, this passage is simultaneously bizarre and familiar to us, simultaneously exotic and domestic. It's strange because none of us have gathered quail in the desert like this. But it's familiar because who of us does not know what it is to eat a little too much and have it not be good for you? I mean, every Thanksgiving we reenact this, don't we? To a small degree. This passage shows us the issue when the very thing we think we want, the thing we ask for, is the thing causing our undoing and the foolishness we have in asking for it. In each of these weeks, what we want to do is take something that seems so archaic, so outdated, and see how we do the exact same thing today. Most of us think of the wrath of God merely in terms of lightning bolts. God's wrath, thunderstorms, maybe a horrible disease, maybe swords and shields of a conquering army. We have no idea how the wrath of God typically works. Look what the people do. Verses 5 and 6 are selective memory, selective reasoning. It's a plain denial of facts. They only remember the things that help their own case, and they forget everything else. They forget the things that hurt their case. When you and I are on a sinful, self-destructive path, what we do is we screen out any evidence that's against our request and any evidence that makes your adversary appear less bad to you. You just screen it out, can't process it. Anything that would be in favor of your opponent's case. One pastor has said, "Are you bearing a grudge? You can't crave vengeance and be rational." You can't. You can't be after revenge. You have to be irrational if you're after revenge. You have to be sifting the evidence according to just what suits you, not to what's objective. Verse 20 is a fascinating line. All right, we've got selective reasoning. Verse 20 is a picture of tolerance. You will love the quail. You will desire the quail. You'll be satisfied with the quail at first. But you are going to get more and more of it, and it's going to satisfy you less and less until eventually it's coming out your nose and you're going to hate it. That's how tolerance works. This is a picture of sin as addiction. Right? Notice you get to the end, verses 32 and 33, and they are thinking that something other than the Lord will satisfy them, the meat, and they get it in spades. And it does the exact opposite of what they're hoping for. And in modern terms, we might say, when you look to the very thing that is the cause of your distress and you think it will be the solution to your distress, that's what it means to be an addict. You're hooked on something, it's ruining your life, and you think, I just need to get more of it to drown my sorrows, to get away from my distress. It's viciously cyclical. Numbers 11 is presenting you an addiction cycle, and it is saying this is not just substance abuse, this is the power of sin in our own hearts. It's going to promise you something. It's going to give a little at first. You're going to develop tolerance to it. You're going to have denial and selective reasoning about everything else, and it is going to turn into a vicious, vicious cycle, taking you further away from God. The power of sin as addiction. And we all take a step back and we look at these people and we say, how could they do that? How foolish. How could they think that? Don't they remember they were slaves in Egypt? We all want to take a step back from them, but don't do it. Don't separate yourselves from them. This is the nature of sin, and it's in every single one of us in our natural selves. Each of us wants to look to something other than God and say, if only, if only. And it ramps up and ramps up from there. And when you are in the middle of that kind of cycle, the very worst thing that can happen for you is for God to say, okay, fine. That's what you want? Go right ahead. I will hold you back no longer. Let me give you a couple of examples. And Casey's going to read another quote for us. It's allergy season. I'm very grateful for his help today and for your patience. Let me give you a couple of examples here. When you look to something other than God, It could be something awful like drugs, where we typically go when we think about addiction, or it could be something noble like success. Success. Whatever it is, when you look to something other than God, there are several different ways it can be bad for you. There is a woman who worked with celebrities, and she had the privilege of knowing some of these celebrities both before and after their big break. And listen to what she said in one article as she wrote about her experience with some of these famous people.
I pity celebrities. No, I really do. Sylvester Stallone, Bruce Willis, and Barbara Streisand were once perfectly pleasant human beings, but now their wrath is awful. I think when God wants to play a really rotten practical joke on you, he grants you your deepest wish and then laughs merrily when you realize you want to kill yourself. You see, Sly, Bruce, and Barbara wanted fame. They worked, they pushed. In the morning after each of them became famous, they wanted to take an overdose. Because that giant thing they were striving for, that fame thing that was going to make everything okay, that was going to make their lives bearable, that was going to provide them with personal fulfillment and happiness, had happened, and they were still them. The disillusionment turned them howling and insufferable.
How's it work? You want something other than God. And for those three, it was fame. For all of us, it's something. You want something other than God, he gives it to you, and you realize you still have a gaping hole. It turns you utterly miserable. The thing you thought would fill it does not. Here's the second way. If all you're after is success, and God gives it to you early, you can have some horrendous character flaw that desperately needs to be dealt with, and you'll think you're just fine. It's no big deal. Because all you were after is success, and you got it in spite of this character flaw, and you'll never ever listen to anyone who has the boldness to try to confront you on it. You'll be stunted for life because you got what you thought you needed. Right? It's going to hurt you in the rest of life. But here's the way that's most relevant to this passage. When God gives you what you want, and the thing itself is your own punishment. Here's what I mean. If you gossip, it's not just, I know I shouldn't gossip, but I did anyways, and it was a mistake, but the rest of my life will be fine. No, if you gossip, what you are doing is taking your social faculties, your social relationships, and twisting them around your own pride, your own need for affirmation and meaning, and you are breaking trust with others, using them to get your own ego strokes. And if you do that, you'll constantly be wondering who is doing the same to you. It'll poison your social relationships. It is its own punishment in the very area of the sin itself. Its own punishment. Sexual sin. It's not arbitrary to bring it up. The name of the place, Kibroth Hatta'avah, means graves of craving, graves of desire, or graves of lust. When someone has an addiction to pornography, we might be tempted to think, okay, they're not supposed to do that. They're making a mistake. This is an error. They should not do that. They're choosing sexual fulfillment over God, but they're still getting their sexual fulfillment. It's not the right choice. They shouldn't be doing it, but they're at least getting fulfillment in the area of their choosing. No. What's happening? Don't you see, they don't become more and more adept even sexually, but less. Sexual fulfillment does not increase, but decrease. They have more problems. Their mind shrivels. They get caught in a rut. They're more unable in the very area of their perversion, of their disobedience, not less. It's death itself in the very area of our sin. If you make marriage your ultimate thing, you will place a weight on your spouse that your spouse is never able to fulfill, and your marriage itself will be spoiled between your teeth. You can do it with family and children. You can demand so much from them until eventually you drive them away. If power is your thing, when you get power, you will always be suspicious that others are after it. after the power you have. You can never use your power to do what it was meant for rest, for enjoyment, and for selfless shepherding of other people. You can have power out your nostrils and hate it and be miserable. It'll never be enough. This is how sin works. And see the mercy of God in what he does not give you. See the wisdom and love of God in what he restrains, what he is holding back. Romans 1, therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity, saying, this is what you're set on, fine, go ahead. Should be words that make us shudder. And Psalm 7, God is a righteous judge, a God who expresses his wrath every day. Do you know that? Do you recognize he's expressing his wrath every single day? And so often, this is how he is doing it, by giving us the very things we're asking for. We have our first two-year-old as a family. It has been said that two is the age where you teach and where you learn. There is a God in the universe, and you're not him, right? We have a bicycle ready for Graham. He's not ready for it yet. There are no training wheels. It's for the future. But the other day, he saw it and asked to ride it, and I thought, okay, we can make this work. So I blew up the tires. I put him on the back, started to go, holding on, my arms around him on the handlebars, going forward. What did he start to do? Started to whine. No, no, by myself. He's two. There are no training wheels. What would have happened if I had just said, by yourself? Okay. Right? Crash and burn. Immediately. And I thought about it by way of illustration. You know, just put a video on this and get it ready for today. That was a joke, yeah. Voice inflection is a powerful thing when public speaking, but I'm holding on to him. I'm restraining where he can go by myself. The fact that I didn't let go doesn't mean I'm a better father than God. No, he's an infant. God is working with fully formed people, bringing desires to him over time, thinking them out. Sin is a self-destructive power that causes us to ask for things that are not good for us. Even at times, to pursue things we know are not good for us. And the simplest way for God to express his love is to restrain us. And the simplest way for us, for him to express his wrath, is to say, hands off. Have at it. Recognize his love for you in the times when he tells you no. Sin as an addiction. So what's the intervention? What's the solution? Well, Moses intercedes. And Moses' complaint had been, it's too much. It's too much for me. I would rather die than carry the burden of all of these people to their promise. And God's immediate answer to help Moses is these 70 elders. But the fuller answer to Moses' complaint came many years later. Jesus Christ comes, and he looks out over a rebellious people of God, Matthew 23, looks out over people full of rebellion and complaint, and says not, I'd rather die than carry them. But no, he says, I will die in order to carry them. I will give of my, I will die to carry them all the way to the promise. And he does it, Mark 14, by praying just before the cross, not what I want, but what you want. Exact reversal of the people's rebellion. And he goes to the cross. He loses his freedom. He's nailed so that in him you might be fully set free, finally free of our addiction cycle. So that in him, with the Son of David, we might remade, say along with Psalm 16, the boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. the boundary lines. You can't go there. That's pleasant. Surely I have a delightful inheritance with what he has given me and with what he has held back. Not rebelling, not complaining, but him carrying and caring and us receiving whatever he gives us, content with what he provides. Now, Pastor Tim Keller points out that in verse 6, when the people say, we have lost our appetite, that is actually a very profound statement talking about the loss of our will. And this is what sin eventually does to us. It erodes our very capacity to will and to choose. And Keller says, when you live for anything other than God, you will find the more you get it, the more you need it, and the less satisfying it is as your heart and your emotions are shriveling. The more you fuel a fire, the more it needs. And the only way to break the addiction cycle is in Christ to begin to have an appetite for God that is greater than our appetite for these other things. It's never just look at these other things and say, I'm going to want them less. No, you have to want something more than those things. And that's what we do in worship. That's what we're going to do with this final song. Collectively singing to God, we are hungry for you. Other appetites pale in comparison. Hunger for you. Give us a greater desire for you than all other things. Would you pray with me as we prepare to worship him together? Father, I pray that these words may indeed be true in our hearts this morning, that you would fill us in such a way as to replace and drive out all our other thirsts, hungers, and appetites. I pray that you would give us ruthless honesty with ourselves and outside voices who would speak the truth to us. Help us to be receptive to them. Father, may we see and trust your mercy in the things that you withhold. May we do it more and more as we hunger for you, that we would truly say, you are everything to us, all that we need. May it be our prayer that those words would indeed be true in our hearts. A.B. Simpson was the man who founded the Christian Missionary Alliance Church. And A.B. Simpson once wrote this, we must learn to acquiesce in God's refusals and to believe where we cannot see that he has something better for us than the work we chose. To do this without losing time and without becoming discouraged and morbid requires the very highest manifestation of the grace of God and the Spirit of Christ. To do it without becoming bitter. To learn to wait without fretting, without petulance, without haste, is the perfection of Christian discipline and the best preparation possible for effective work. The order of service is first tarry, wait. First tarry, then do. May God give us trust in his merciful withholding as a body. May we serve him as we desire him above all other things. May the Lord bless you as we follow him in this. Have a great week.